This episode of Here Be Monsters contains strong descriptions of dead bodies. Please listen with discretion.
I look at my pictures then, and I look like a little kid. That's really kind of funny to even think about. 20s. I was 21. Quit school and joined the military.
It's funny to think that, you know, 4-year stint has such a huge impact in somebody's life.
The Iowa's commander orders her 9 16-inch guns to fire a mighty salvo.
Here Be Monsters, the podcast about
spans of time I can't even account for.
The podcast about
the unknown. No.
The USS Iowa is a World War II battleship. It was the battleship that brought President Roosevelt over to Casablanca to meet with Churchill and Stalin. It's 887 feet long, 3 turrets of 3 16-inch guns. The entire ship was fitted out with brass fittings, and parts of the decks were teak wood. People in deck division would get out there and they'd all stand in line and move this sandpaper kind of mop sort of thing back and forth to scrub the decks. Not like the new Navy ships. This was old school. We were off Puerto Rico. We're in the Caribbean. It was April. It was sunny. It was warm. Pretty beautiful day. I was totally slacking off. And I remember I was laying on this steel box in the Sky 4 gun tub where they used to have the 20 millimeter guns, the ones that you see in the movies that had the alternating doom, 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 and trying to shoot down the planes or something. And everybody else is kind of running around, you know, doing their own things in and out of the radar room. We're also doing 16-inch gun shoots. So the 16-inch guns are shooting. Kind of the equivalent of a very, very short earthquake where the entire ship moves. The explosion, you know, you'd feel it. And at one point, there's this a lower rumble. It had a completely different feel and a completely different sound. And it just continued. It's like, you know how when thunder hits, and it hits, and then it goes, when it just keeps going for a little bit off in the distance, you feel that? That's kind of how it felt. And I sit up. I see this 40-foot long, heavy-duty rubber gasket that weighs probably about a ton, and it's flying through the air, it's passing us, going aft. And then all the smoke starts coming back. It's really dark and heavy. And I just turned to the guys, I go, get to your fucking duty stations right now. And then the general quarters alarm starts going off.
General quarters, general quarters, all hands man your battle station.
You just fall right into combat mode. You fall into, I've got to do this and this and this. This is an emergency situation. I don't even have the brain capacity to speculate what could have gone wrong yet. I need to get to my general quarter stations. So I had to run to the front of the ship, and it was, you know, the center gun was just hanging there, and there was just tons and tons of smoke coming out of it, and the firefighting teams were spraying it down with water.
Thank you.
throughout the day, there's all people talking about, oh, maybe it was a missile hit, maybe it was this, maybe it was that. But I think most people on board realized that it was an internal explosion. And so they decided to flood the turret. And they filled it with water. And I'm not quite sure when the fire got put out, because it's, you know, was it hours? Was it a full day? I don't quite remember. You know, you're in autopilot and you're just doing. And then it's funny, some of the things I remember really vividly, other parts, there's spans of time I can't even account for. The next thing I remember, I'm standing right next to turret two, and I'm one of the people that's going inside. I volunteered to go inside. Yeah, it's tough to talk about. We knew that there wasn't going to be anybody alive, because if they didn't get exploded, if they didn't get blown up, then they were drowned. I volunteered to go inside turret two because I needed to. I knew that there was going to be devastation. I knew that there's going to be dead bodies. And I just knew that I had to go in there and help in whatever way I could. And so I climb up inside the turret, and I'm immediately disoriented. The inside of the turret does not look like the inside of the turret. It's broken and burnt, and there's panels and machinery that aren't where they're supposed to be. And everything's dark inside, and the only light that's coming in is through the front end of where the guns stick out. Everything is black, and everything is dripping from the firefighting water. And it smells. It's just like in the back of my head that this is what it smells like. It smells like kind of like a barbecue with gas. And in my mind, I recall thinking, this is what cooked human beings smell like. And I remember crawling down, I think it was the hoist, but the hoist didn't look like the hoist. It just looked like twisted metal and a gigantic hole. And so I get down to, it's the trainer spot, the guy that moves the turret horizontally. I am just in this gigantic carnage dump. And I'm thinking, I think the trainer was Petty Officer Bop, this good old boy from South Carolina. I'm like thinking, this is where Bop was when it all blew up. I'm just like getting handfuls of flesh. I'm getting handfuls of fat. And if it's organic, we put it into a trash bag. And I'm just like looking at it going, organic? Into the bag. And I'm thinking, this is Petty Officer Bop. I grab the remnants of a shirt, a blue navy shirt, and the button seam is there. There's a little bit off on the shoulders, and the collar is there, and it's just like the thickest part of the shirt remained, but nothing else. And it's covered with oily water and burnt flesh and everything, and I'm just like, into the bag. And I'm thinking that I just put Petty Officer Bop's shirt into the bag. And I'm just scooping stuff and putting it into the bag. And that was what was left of Bop.
In the bag.
All of the body parts that we were recovering were just going to go to some lab someplace. I imagine that they would have done some sort of testing and said, oh, this is this guy's elbow or whatever, and put it into a box in some Navy archive or in some, you know, military gravesite. And that feeling of just being another number was kind of getting to me. And at some point, I don't remember where I was in there, if I was still at the trainer's position or a different position, I'm feeling around and I get this chunk and I lift it up, and it's a piece of bone. It's about the size of my palm. And it's flat. And I'm holding it, I'm thinking, maybe it's part of a skull. Maybe it's part of a shoulder blade or pelvic bone. I don't know who it is. and I slide it into my pocket. And I keep doing stuff throughout the day. At the time, I don't know why I put it in my pocket. It just seemed like it needed to go into my pocket. It was just crazy. I'm pissed. I remember I'm angry. I'm pissed off. There's a body on the deck earlier the day. They said, get that body off the deck. It wasn't, get our shipmate off the deck. Get that sailor off the deck. Get Seaman Lewis, who just got on board the ship. They didn't say, get Lewis off the deck. They didn't say any of that. They said, get that body. It seemed minimalizing everybody and everything. It was like somewhere stored in the back of my head, like, that's fucked up. The chain of command on the ship wasn't telling us what happened, how many people were actually dead. I had to hear it from a civilian radio station from Puerto Rico that 47 of our shipmates died. Eventually, the official word came out that they were blaming Clayton Hartwig, that he had blown up the ship, that he was gay and that his boyfriend had left him and that he became suicidal and so he wanted to take the entire ship with him. And my first class was pissed. My first class knew exactly what they were up to. They were basically trying to frame this guy. They needed to find some sort of scapegoat. It was total BS. Clayton Hartwig's sister basically got Congress to do an independent investigation. And Congress found that it was a mechanical error. And it was also a policy error of like how they were keeping the black powder. It was far easier for them to try to point the finger. When I finally got topside again, outside of the turret, this little area of total devastation around the turret too, I walked off a little ways and I noticed that the deck's teak wood was like burnt. And I took this chunk of bone out of my pocket and I just winged it over the side. And I thought, now you're free. They're not going to own you. They're not going to have that little bit of you. You're out of here, buddy. The USS Iowa is now a museum down in Long Beach. Some of my old shipmates I'm connected to on Facebook. They're like, let's go meet there. Some of them have been down there. I have this desire to go there and an aversion to go there. I'm still unsure if I'd ever go back and walk the decks of the USS Iowa. I loved that ship. I was on that ship for almost 4 years. And it's weird to have that many feelings all jumbled together. I kind of think that I would go back into that mode where you take your emotions and you put them in that little box and hide them away. And then I would just go to my berthing. I'd go to Sky 1. I'd go back to Sky 4. I'd take a look at Turret 2. I would walk those halls. I'd walk those passageways, yeah. And then maybe deal with the emotions of that afterwards.
Chase was a third-class fire controlman who served on the USS Iowa and the USS Vulcan. Today he teaches history and sociology and works with recent veterans at a college in Olympia, Washington. The accident that he witnessed aboard the USS Iowa, it happened quite a while ago. It was 1989. And so in these last 25 years, three different investigations have taken place into the explosion. The Navy has formally apologized for blaming Clayton Hartwig, but it still officially believes that the explosion's cause was, quote, undetermined, despite the findings of the congressional inquiry. So there's a lot of different things to unpack in this episode, and we only covered just this tiny, tiny little portion of it. So we've written up this article and have some archival footage over on the podcast website. That's at hbmpodcast.com. There, you'll also be able to see some rare photos of the explosion's aftermath and a couple pictures of Eric when he was in his 20s aboard the USS Iowa. The website is also where you can find links to all of Here Be Monster's social media sites, and you can also listen to old episodes and see our image galleries. That's all at hbmpodcast.com. This episode was co-produced by myself, Jeff Entman, and Alex Keim. Alex is an audio engineer and writer based in Chicago. He produced another recent episode of Here Be Monsters. It's called Fugitives of the Blue Laguna. Check it out. The music you heard on this show was from Phantom Fauna, Cirocell, Swamp Dog, and Olecranon Rebellion. Alright, you know that Here Be Monsters loves you, and hopefully you love us back for being an unusual podcast, independently distributed and heard across the galaxy, but, you know, we want you to show us your love. Download the show, tell your friends about it, burn episodes of the podcast onto CDs and hand them out to strangers. You can teach your grandma how to use BitTorrent, and while you're at it, you can pick up some litter, too. And if you have just 2 minutes after you've done all that, just 2 minutes, write Here Be Monsters a review on iTunes, because we're just so close to being the number one philosophy podcast on the iTunes podcast directory, so your support really helps. New episodes soon. Thanks so much for listening.